Hi, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the IAC podcast. My name is Ohad Meislish, and I have an amazing, well-known guest today, Mr. Maddie Stratton. Hi, Maddie.
Hey, how's it going?
Happy whatever day of the week it is.
I think it's Thursday. But
Thursday sounds good. Let's call it Thursday.
yet another sunny day here in California. Cool. Maddie, thanks for joining us today. For those who don't know you yet, can you share a little bit about your background, please?
Absolutely. One of the things, so currently, just for context, I run developer advocacy and relations for a company called Ivan. I've been in the DevRel space for the last few years, but the way I would always explain my job to people is I say, I worked in tech ops for 2 decades and now they pay me to talk about it. So that's kind of journey-wise, I spent many years, 20-plus years, technology operations, sysadmin stuff, and lots of different finance and insurance. I'm in Chicago. These are the things we do here. And I got involved in the DevOps movement kind of early on and was very, very interested and intrigued by that for lots of reasons that we'll talk about. And that's also around the time that I kind of flipped from, as you say, working for a living to then being on the vendor side. So I've been at places like Chef, you know, which is relevant to our conversation. I was at PagerDuty,
yep.
Red Hat, Pulumi, and now most recently at Ivan. Always working with folks in the community to try to help them be more successful and, you know, get rid of all the stuff that sucks and replace it with things that suck, maybe just a little bit less, you know.
So speaking of Chef, shout out to Adam Jacob and another episode we had in the IC podcast. If you want to hear more about Adam Jacob and the journey of Chef and what he has been doing later on, please go to another episode of the IC podcast. So back to you, Maddie. I think, you know, with your vast experience, both hands-on and different technologies and community, let's talk about the journey. And maybe let's start with your background from Chef, a configuration management solution. And let's talk about how you codify and automate your actions and what happened in the last 10 or 15 years with the technology. So if you can give us that perspective, let's start with Chef. What Chef brought to the, let's say, DevOps engineer, and what was missing later on that you think evolved additional technologies?
Yeah, that's great. So if we kind of think about the evolution, and again, we probably would have always referred to Chef as like a configuration management tool, just because we didn't really call it InfraCode as a name kind of started to happen around there. But Chef was almost the beginnings of that in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. So without going too much into all the history, and I'll send you a link you can put in your show notes. Kat Cosgrove has an amazing talk about the historical context of IAC, digs into this more, but kind of we started with CF Engine, right? You know, Mark Burgess, you know, created this awesome thing, this were promise theory, all these things come up, but it was light years beyond anything we used to have, which was writing bash scripts or click next, all this kind of fun stuff. Lou Kinese came up with Puppet, which was kind of a fun thing where he sat there and said, I want to be able to, and Puppet was really kind of the first modern configuration management. Chef came up, and I'm sure Adam talks about this maybe in the show, where the problem was Puppet did not scale well to, you know, what we would call in the mod, as I would say, web scale, right? So we're trying to say, how do we make things happen at a greater scale? Because in the kind of the cloud era. But what Chef brought that was different was instead of having to kind of only work within the domain-specific language or the configuration language of the tool, be it CF Engine or Puppet, you wrote your Chef configurations using Ruby. And why that matters, there's a couple of great benefits when you move into that. One thing is you get a true programming language, you know, has all the things that programming languages have, like loops and variables and all sorts of stuff. But what the power of that is you get everything that that programming language's ecosystem has available. So what Chef got for free by being based in Ruby was all of Ruby's code testing tools, all of Ruby's linting, all of that stuff. And then what was interesting, and then you flash forward a little bit to when I joined Pulumi, and what I always was excited about with Pulumi is Pulumi was like the realization of what Chef could have been. And the limitations with Chef were less about anything with Chef, but about the era. So if we think about it in the era of Puppet and Chef, when those were coming up, what we reasoned about for our infrastructure was operating systems. We were configuring Linux and everything on top of Linux, or configuring Windows and IIS and everything on top of that.
Aya, yes. Wow, that brings back memories.
Oh, man, I've written some cookbooks about IIS. Fun fact, I was one of the first internet-certified, Microsoft-certified professionals. IIS 3.0 exam. Anyway, but then in the more cloud era, we reasoned about cloud resources. And one of the powerful things about that is they're all API-driven, and you know what you can and can't do. So one of the big challenges, if you're saying, I want to configure an operating system, it's harder to define the desired state of that operating system because there's so many different things that could be different, right? Mm-hmm. Do I have this file here? Do this file here? If you think about configuring things within AWS or Azure or DigitalOcean or whatever, there is a limited number of things and you know exactly what they look like. And that gives us the power, and that's where Terraform and Pulumi and tools that reason at that level can do a lot more desired state. The thing with Pulumi is it was not limited just to, it's not just limited to Ruby. It has multiple programming languages. So it kind of is the window to the cloud for people who want to reason in that way, whichever is the thing that makes the most sense to you. One of the most powerful things of all of these tools is abstractions, right? Mm-hmm. Is that it gives building blocks for people who only want to implement the thing that they understand. So back the example I would give when I was a chef, I would think about, you know, Tomcat. Okay, so you're in your organization, you have using something like Tomcat or WebSphere or whatnot. There are 30,000 different dials you can turn on Tomcat, right?
Yep.
So if I'm a software engineer that is like, I just need to spin up a Tomcat server according to my standards, but maybe there's only four dials that I should be allowed to turn because my middleware admin who knows how we do that, so you create in Chef, it would have been a resource, a custom resource or anything you call it that says, this is my corp Tomcat and it exposes three parameters and I can tune yep. those parameters, but I will know that everything else will be set up according to the way it was supposed to be. And people do that today with Kubernetes, right? Same thing, you want to spin yep. up a Kubernetes cluster. And this allows us as the person who cares about that configuration that wants to extend the ability to do it to ensure that every time it's done right. And there's an organization, I can't share who it was, but is a big one, when I was at Pulumi, who used Pulumi as their standard way of deploying Kubernetes clusters. And what yep. using something like Pulumi, you could do this with other tools, it's nothing specific to Pulumi, but using a robust IAC for this is those, if I was a developer that wanted to spin up a Cates cluster in this organization, it did not have to get vetted. I could just do it. But versus if I built it myself, I would have to do this. And now the security team will do a security review and make sure I did everything right. But if you're using it with the defined infracode resource, you don't have to test it because you can't do it wrong. You know, it's where it doesn't matter.
It's yeah. pre-approved. So I think what you're starting to talk about is, you know, the goal of empowering developers with self-service catalog or self-service infrastructure flavors. Mm-hmm. And if you have the flexibility of a native programming language such as Ruby, it allows you to be very flexible and powerful in what you create and then delegate to the rest of the organization. So let's talk about the skills that are needed in order for me to be able to do this job, to be able to administrate my infrastructure and my applications and to properly empower the rest of the organization with the needed flexibility, not too less and not too much of flexibility. So if I'm thinking about 10 years ago, my capabilities were pretty limited because I was focusing on ClickOps. I was focusing on clicking the right button in Windows or changing some configurations in Linux. And then goes to maybe more application servers or web servers. You mentioned IIS, you've mentioned Tomcat. But now sounds like I need to really become a programmer and know things like Ruby or know things like whatever I want to use Pulumi with, or I need to know HCL and Terraform in order to be able to create those templates and to empower those developers. So I'm kind of switching from ClickOps to become somewhat a developer, do you tend to agree that there is some changes of the skills of those DevOps engineers, or do you look at it differently?
I think it's nuanced. I don't think it's as, and there's two things to unpack in that. The first one is the most important skill is to know what you're actually trying to do. You know, sure. So I can be super good at Chef, but if I don't understand what Tomcat yet is for, or what I want it to look like, I you know, so you have to begin with knowing what you want to accomplish and having the skills of, I always give the example when I think about Agile, it's like you put sticky notes on the wall before you buy Rally, right? So the same thing, before you create an automation, you have to know how to do it the hard way, right? You know, learn how to use the darkroom before you use Photoshop, maybe, or you'll be way better in Photoshop if you've worked in a darkroom. Okay, that's interesting. That's a given, or not a given, but if we say that. But when we think about saying, now I'm evolving into like having to be a developer, one of the things, as I've helped so many people who are, you know, come from the tech ops background that are like, now I need to learn Chef or Pulumi or whatever, and it's all this dev stuff. I said, all of these things, when we talk about development, they're things sysadmins do. We just use different words. So we don't talk about programming. We talk about scripting. Even if you're mostly have done ClickNext, even in my days that before it was easy to do this kind of thing in Windows and I would have been a ClickNext admin, I wrote VB scripts to do things. I wrote lots. Every tech op worth their salt has figured out, they know how to create something automated. Might not be pretty, might not be nice code, but we know how to script. We do.
Yep.
Right? So that's programming. That's all that is. That's just taking a thing you do and telling a robot how to do it. We don't know how to do that. We don't call it debugging. We call it troubleshooting. We debug all the time as tech ops people. We just call it troubleshooting, right? You know, and so part of that is saying, yes, the specifics, you might not know Go or whatever, but you know how to reason about it. And the other thing that is really important to know is that the level of programming expertise you need to have in any of these languages is very light, because you are still, for the most part, doing relatively simple programmatic things like loops, like conditionals, like if-thens, stuff like that. You're not doing memory management and pointers and, you know, object-oriented stuff and all these things.
Hardcore programming.
Right. Yeah. And there are cases now you can do those things with these. And if you're going to build something very complex, like a portal and things like that, but most of the time, the things to pick up are relatively light and you come to them pretty quickly. Right. You know, it's like you do them a little bit. You're like, and because it's a lot of rinse and repeat, right? You're like, you're going to write the same loop in all your Pulumi code for everything you do when you learn how to write a loop and pass something into a referent. Right. So it is a switch, but like I said, it's a nuanced change and it's an enhancement. It's not like you were someone who worked in PowerPoint all the time and now you're suddenly going to have to write some code. But you're switching from Bash to maybe JavaScript in a way.
That's a nice thing.
It fit in Bash. It all ends up looking very similar. So
I thinking about my journey. It's funny that you mentioned VB scripts. I also started with VB scripts. Later on, moving more to the Linux OS and using Bash. Later on, Python. Later on, configuration management. And later on, infrastructure as code. But all in all, you need to understand what you're trying to achieve, because it doesn't matter if you know Python, if you don't know the core pieces of your infrastructure and how it runs and what are the implications to the changes that you want to, to impact your infrastructure, even being the best programmer doesn't help, as you mentioned. You need to understand what you're trying to achieve.
Right. Think about it this way: like two things. You know, we say that fundamentally, infra code, all these things are desired state management. Right. Yep. So you need to know the first two words in that. You need to know what is the desired state and why should that be the desired state? Because at the end of the day, all of these tools, all they are test and repair loops. They're just a thing saying, does the thing look the way that OAuth said it should? If not, make it look like that. in various ways, right? If you're immutable, the way you make it look like that is creating a new one maybe or something. But all we're doing there is just over and over saying, this is what we want. If it's like that, sweet. If not, make it like that. There you go. That's everything about InfraCode, and it's test repair loop. That's all it is. So,
all right.
Yeah. But you can't test for the test repair loop if you don't know what to test. And if you don't understand that, yes, this is what these things, and it's interesting because one of the things that would come up quite a bit in Chef, and you can do this with things like Terraform and Pulumi that are reasoning about clouds and I'll explain in a way, is they would say, okay, why can't I just point Chef or Puppet at my Apache servers and have it generate a cookbook or a module to make my servers look like that? You know why? Because Chef doesn't know what all of those things on that entire operating system, what are relevant and what are not, you know, whereas if you were going to point it towards your VPCs or things like that, that's where I said about having that standard set of APIs. But what would happen oftentimes where I would work with folks who are going to adopt Chef is they would say, okay, we want to write the cookbook to build our Apache servers. And I would say, how are your Apache servers configured? And people oftentimes would say, like, I don't know, we have an image. We just re-image them off the golden image and they go. And so that's how you get all that fun tech debt too, right? You get that cruft. How many times in the olden days of sysadmin, you'd be on machines and you're like, why is this like this? And it's or my favorite, this is where InfraCode is so good. I'm sure you've had this too, is you ever been a place where you could log into a server and you could tell who built it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I said, there'd be like, yep, Barry did this one.
It smells like this person. Yeah,
exactly.
It looks like.
Everybody has their idiosyncrasies.
This configuration, this flavor looks, it reminds me of him or her. Yeah, definitely.
I want to point out, this reminded me of one of my favorite quotes from Mark Burgess, which said, every time that you log onto a system interactively, you compromise everybody's understanding of that system just by logging into it. So that's the other power of doing this is it's, you know, InfraCode is executable documentation, right? And if I know that the way that my systems are configured is through Terraform and only through Terraform, then I can know what they look like just by looking at the Terraform code. But if then people have the ability to SSH into the system, just the fact that they have the ability to do it, I now have lost all my trust in that system, or at least my trust of my understanding of that system, because it can change. And this is where you will occasionally run into the ideas of split brain, right? One fun thing that happens often is maybe, let's say you've got, we would run into this a lot too, is people were wanting to migrate from Puppet to Chef. And then they would have Puppet and Chef, or Chef and Ansible configured.
Managing the same. Wow.
And then you're like, well, who's in charge? Or likewise, at PagerDuty, for example, you could configure PagerDuty with Terraform. Annoyingly, you could not configure everything about PagerDuty. The provider did not do everything. So the problem is you could write all this cool Terraform to configure PagerDuty, but someone has to be able to also go in and then they can click around in the UX, and you're either going to run into that any manual changes you make get pulled out from underneath you and you don't know why, or more likely, you don't know what it looks like. I'll tell you a fun story about the thing about wrapping your brain around the model of config management. Before I started using Chef, I had a brief foray with Puppet when I was at a place called apartments.com, and we were moving, we had some new systems, and I said, okay, I want to use this new fancy thing called Puppet instead of the manual way. And they were these WordPress servers, and I had built them out. We had the different environments, and then one of our designers came to me and said, oh, hey, I'm staging, this is wrong, it's missing an image or something. And I was like, oh, okay, I'll fix that for you, no problem. And then half an hour later, he came over, he goes, Maddie, it's broken again. Well, I went and I fixed it. And then half an hour later, Puppet came along and went and put it right back. And that was like, some of the only way you learn that you have to do it that way is to get burned by it. And luckily, this wasn't prod. It wasn't a big deal.
Yeah, yeah. That's what I wanted to say. It sounds like it's a staging game.
To figure out that's what happened. In my defense, this was 2012 and it was all new concepts. You know, it took a minute to like remember this was a thing that existed.
Interesting. So basically, you're describing a drift, and luckily, the drift detection in your WordPress story was somebody telling you, hey, that's stopped working. Yeah. So
I created the drift. And
luckily it was only a staging issue, not a production issue. And it was not a CrowdStrike implications that gets the entire world impossible to do anything with something like CrowdStrike. Let's talk about the technologies that you can maybe use. So, okay, you have different options. You mentioned, for example, Terraform and Pulumi, and we know there are more options. As back in the day, with Chef, you mentioned Puppet and Ansible. And because, Maddie, you're involved in the community, in DevOps days, in open source, what are your thoughts about the importance of open source when you make these decisions? If I'm an engineer or an architect, let's say a cloud architect or an infrastructure architect, and I now need to choose some technologies, would you recommend having the open source and the ecosystem as a main factor in my decision-making process? How do you look at decision-making process for choosing the technologies nowadays?
I think when it comes to open source, it's interesting to see how that evolution has happened in terms of the embracing of it, maybe begrudgingly according from some leadership. But again, I remember days of that, if in organizations, the CIO would have to review every single, anything that was open source that came into the organization. It's like, hey, I want to use this library. Oh, I need CIO approval. We need to make sure. And it's sort of flipped on its head because people are starting to understand that, you know, the power you get with open source, again, is you know what it's doing. I think a term that I don't believe he coined it, but who brought it to my attention, John Allspaugh, is work as imagined versus work as done. And I this idea of, if it's open source, I will interrogate it before I bring it into my environment and know everything it does is work as imagined. Most people don't do that. But you don't have to, because it's open source, you know that people are adopting a similar thing. And you can, if you need to, or there's certain things you're concerned about. The reasons to reason about open source and why it would matter into your bringing it in as a tool, that why I would always look at open source tools first, is longevity. You know, we've seen this in various ways, because let's say it's a closed source thing that some company is doing, and then that company goes out of business or they retire the product or whatever. Now, it doesn't mean that if it was open source, someone would run it, but if it's popular enough, it can go and breathe into new life. Or even if it's super critical to me, I can take that on. And it was interesting, like similarly, one of the reasons when Facebook was a very big user of Chef. I don't know if they still are or not, but they actually very specifically used the pure open, did not use any non-open source features of Chef, because their thought was Facebook was more likely to outlast Chef. And they needed to know that if Chef, that was so critical to them, that if Chef disappeared, they would still be able to continue. They had all the code they needed. They had all the things they could do. So if something is business critical, it's that you don't want to take it. But the reason you used another tool, so you didn't have to write it yourself, but you know you have that capability and the flexibility of being able to build upon it. You know, thinking about things like, I was talking about the example with PagerDuty, where we're like, the API did not, the public API doesn't show everything, you know? Mm-hmm. Whereas if it's an open source project, it's probably more likely to, or you could figure out how to expose that API and work it in that way. So it gives you more flexibility for adaptability, I think is where that ends up coming in. And because of the popularity of open source, that just gets you more of the ability of saying there's more people doing things with it. And you have that community, and that community is really key. And the community is not just about the people and having something in common with them. That's a very powerful, important thing. But the more people trying to solve problems with something, the more likely it is that someone has already tried and maybe succeeded at solving the problem you want to solve. Especially fun when that person was you in a past life and you forgot. If you've ever had that experience where you find a solution of a problem and you find your own blog post that you don't even remember writing because it was however long, you're like, oh, I guess I already fixed this. You know,
that's funny. Sounds like you have an interesting story to share.
So I don't know if that answered the question.
Yeah, definitely. I think you mentioned the longevity and the stability of these projects, and that you can rest assured that no matter what happens to the vendor who created this technology, you can still use it later on.
And these things tend to be by, it's not anything inherent in open source, but it's a correlation versus causation around them tending to be built more on open standards. Right. Mm-hmm. So interoperability among tools that are open source sometimes is a little bit easier because almost by definition, they aren't going to have their own communication protocol standards or things like that because they were built in the open to connect to other things. Whereas if it's something inside of Oracle, it's going to have its own protocol or something like that. And you're like, okay.
Of course. Yeah.
Now that can still happen in open source. Open source projects can create their own shit as much as they want, you know? But by virtue of how those things get built, because it's usually a disparate group of people, you have to settle on something that is relatively standardized.
Definitely. So it's more likely to be open. Cool. Mary, thanks for sharing a lot of thoughts and reflection, you know, for the journey that we're seeing in the last 10 or 15 years and some considerations on how to make some decisions and to be aware of drifts. Don't SSH to your machine if you have code managing that. But if you do, please do on staging, right, Maddie?
Yes, exactly. At least drift there. That's with it.
Cool. Maddie, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing some fun stories and great opinions. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Bye-bye.